Radio 92.3, informative, local, dependable. Good morning. This is Pep Talk, Pensacola's expert panel with Meg. And our expert this morning is definitely an expert on personal injury law. Terrence A. Gross is here with Gross & Schuster, founder of the law firm, managing partner. And he has a resume that I could read and spend the whole half hour reading. So in lieu of that, he's here to share his wisdom with us this morning. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. And I'm going to continue what I did a couple weeks ago and just sort of go down memory lane. I've been a lawyer now for 46 years. So the end of my career is a lot closer than the beginning. Of course, I began in 1979. And beginning of 1979 was an interesting year because that's when they just changed the DUI laws. I think it was 1977 when they made these major changes with all the required sentencings, no more good old boy stuff. Mr. Smith, you're a nice guy. We're going to let you go home, and here's a $50 fine for your DUI. So it became, very harsh sentences, mandatory license suspension, mandatory jail for repeat offenders, and this and that and the other. And the stakes went up, which means more people are apt to want to fight them. Lawyers didn't know how to fight a DUI. And I studied up on it. In fact, my third year of law school, 1979, I interned here at the Public Defender's Office for Jack Baer. And I tried four jury trials, came back with four not guilties. Two of those cases were DUIs.
Wow.
And I got the hang of it. And so when I came out, I hit the ground running. So by early 80s, I pretty much when I came out, 75% of all the work I was doing was DUI defense. So I became a DUI defense lawyer. And I'm talking about the volume was crazy because most of the good old boys didn't know how to try a case. They didn't know how to fight a DUI, how to challenge the intoxilizer, how to do all these things. And I'd learned, read books and whatever, and there was all kinds of things you could do. So probably from 1979 through the mid-80s, I tried 75 DUI jury trials. Pick a jury and go. And my success rate, not bragging, only out of 75, I probably lost about 8. So I had a great success rate, a lot of hard work. And I just knew how to do things. And, I did depositions, which nobody did depositions on misdemeanor cases. I insisted on doing depositions because a lot of times the officers would come in unprepared for a deposition, mm-hmm. and you nail them and it's on paper. Then a trial, when it's going to trial, they're all boned up. It's too late. I already got their sworn testimony with all these inconsistencies. And a lot of times you get a young prosecutor and they didn't even give the prior deposition to the lawyer, to the officer. And it was very easy to cross-examine.
Wow.
And find all kinds of inconsistencies. So anyway, there's a lot of different things, but I would tell you this, because of that experience, and now that I'm a personal injury lawyer,
yes,
you asked me before, do you defend or prosecute? Well, back then I defended DUIs, but what do I do now? I prosecute them civilly. Now, I'm not a criminal prosecutor,
right.
but certainly I'd say out of 100 nowadays, 4 or 5 involve drunken driving out of 100 cases I see,
mm-hmm.
and we prosecute them, and I know exactly how to nail them.
Because you've been on the other side.
It's on the other side. Take that same knowledge to convict them civilly. And, of course, most jurors are not real sympathetic towards a drunken driver. So with that being said, the last show I shared some of my memories or cases. So I was thinking back of some colorful, maybe DUI cases. And actually one involved my secretary's husband.
Oops.
And
he
had gotten arrested. He had refused the breath test, but the officer was real adamant. He couldn't do the walk the line test, couldn't touch his nose, couldn't do all these things and whatever. And so I go to take this young officer's deposition. And the one thing that just stood out to me, just looking at this guy, he was very young. He was uber fit. This guy was, I mean, fit beyond normal fitness. I mean, he was short, but well built, not stocky, but just oozing athleticism. I mean, just oozing it, and short haired and whatever. And one of the things he made a big deal about my client, he says, I had him stand on 1 foot, and he couldn't stand on 1 foot more than 3 seconds. So I just took a stab because my kids played soccer. And I took a stab. I said, did you play soccer? And he started smiling. He goes, oh, yes. And he had played he was a star in high school soccer, played small. And I really got him in. And, of course, nobody knows where I'm going with this. But anybody that's ever watched really good soccer people, what can they do? They could sit there on 1 foot and with the other foot dribble the ball up and down. They could just kick a soccer ball up and down. I mean, it's amazing. And only a soccer person could do that. But the agility and the – so I started getting, you know, they don't know where I'm going, but I'd already set the
trap. I have an idea.
I set the trap for this guy. So I said, so then your balance, I mean, I said, are you one of these guys that can just kick the soccer ball? He said, oh, yeah, I could just sit there. So you have to admit your balance is way better than the average person's. Well, yes. And you're in your late 20s, officer, yes. And this man that you've arrested in his late 40s, and do you know anything about his athleticism? No, I don't. So you would agree that a non-soccer player couldn't just take that ball like that and dribble off 1 foot like you? Yes. And I said, if I asked you to stand on 1 foot, how long could you stand on 1 foot? He goes, forever. I mean, so I just took that, and that was just one of the things. So that was part of it, and I thought the judge would probably tear my head off, because you know how I was almost thinking about bringing a soccer ball to court and bringing the guy down. But what I did do, I did have him stand, I did get him off the stand and have him stand in front of the jury and hold his foot out straight on 1 foot, and he just sat like a statue. And I even argued in my closing argument, I said, before you convict my client, I want each and every one of you in that jury room, you go back in that room and stand on 1 foot and see how long you could hold it and whether you could. So that was just one of the things. So anyway, and there's those other things, you know, the typical stuff, you know, the officer testified, my client's eyes were red. Well, I said, don't other things, allergies, smoke-filled bars, there's things that can cause one. Yes. So, and this, all the other things. And he also put that my client's speech was fine. So I said, well, don't they usually have slurred speech if they're, so it was a little contradiction. So anyway, now we get to jury selection. So now we're picking the jury. And I always had these canned questions for DUI cases. And you had to be very careful because you're trying to figure out who you want to be on the jury, but you also don't want to ask too many questions where you're giving the prosecution ammunition to get rid of one of your jurors.
Right.
So I asked the question, how many of you all are familiar with the performance of field sobriety tests? And about 6 hands went up out of 30. My next question was, how many of you have had law enforcement experience or maybe military police? And about 5 hands. So there's one guy had experience with the DUI test, but no law enforcement. I left it alone. So that quickly move on.
Bingo.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go any further with that, and the prosecution didn't really catch that. But that guy ended up being on my jury because who would have familiarity with the DUI test but not be a police officer or legal trained? So I was thinking, this guy's been arrested for DUI before.
That's pretty clever there.
So I left it alone, and he ends up on the jury. Now, this is the oddest thing because it's the only time it's ever happened to me in my entire career. And so evidence came out. My client had told the police officer, too, that he had two glasses of Greek wine. That was the evidence. But there was no evidence about Greek wine being stronger, not such, just two glasses. That was the testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So they go back to deliberate. And this was in the old Santa Rosa courthouse. We now have a new one, but the old one that is right there by the, you know, Blackwater River, you know, everybody knows in Milton, if you know what I'm talking about, because the new one's only 5 years old probably. But out of that courtroom, you had hard terrazzo floors, no carpet. And the juror room was this heavy wooden door. But whoever hung it left a 3-inch gap at the bottom. So I'm sitting there on a bench, you know, because the lawyer's got nothing to do while you're waiting for the jury to deliberate. So I'm just sitting on this bench right outside the judge's chambers, but about 20 feet from the jury room. And I'm just minding my own business. And I wasn't even looking at my cell phone because there was no such thing as a cell phone back then.
That's
right. So I'm just sitting there doing, twiddling my thumbs probably, when all of a sudden I realize I'm hearing deliberations. This is the only time, and I'm starting to wonder, I wonder if I should move. This is probably not right. I might do anything illegal. And just as I was getting ready to maybe move, the prosecutor sat down next to me.
Oops.
And he, now the thing, I was rarely in this courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
He was in that courtroom every day. So he already knew just found out that you. So we're just sitting there. So I figure, okay, he's sitting there. If he's not objecting. So we both sat there.
Huh.
And somebody goes in that court in there. Let's just put the vote now. Let's just see where we're at. Let's just vote. And it was 5 guilties and 1 not guilty.
Oh.
So one of the guilties starts saying, well, it's Greek wine. We all know that Greek wine is stronger than ordinary wine. And then this other fellow that they're not going to say, there's no evidence. The judge just said you're supposed to base your verdict on the law and the evidence. There's been no evidence. The prosecution did not present evidence that's stronger. So you're bringing in something that's not in the evidence. You're not supposed to do that. And so then it kept on going. It's getting a little tense in there. And finally, we hear this not guilty juror say, I was arrested for DUI and I was innocent. I had to get a lawyer, go through the whole system. And they finally dropped charges at the last minute. But I know what it likes to be falsely charged with DUI and just whatever. So after about an hour, they all go his way. So they reluctantly agree. So the prosecution's heard this. So now we go back into the courtroom. They go, okay, we got a verdict. So the lawyers go, my client, we're all sitting there. And then the foreman stands up. And the judge says, well, do you have a verdict? And the foreman goes, yes, not guilty, Your Honor. Well, under Florida law, the losing party is allowed to poll the jurors to make sure it's all, because all verdicts have to be unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be 5-1, even on a civil case. It's got to be unanimous. So the prosecution already knew that there's some people not real happy, and he was hoping that maybe one changed their mind. Maybe somebody's, you know. So he goes, they go, so the judge goes, Mr. Smith, is that your verdict? Not guilty. Yes. And finally, there's the last guy, and he looked like he'd just drinking castor oil or something. And he goes, yes. I mean, you could tell he was not happy, but he wanted to get home or whatever right. it was. So ended up being a not guilty and whatever. But I guess it was two morals to that story. But the one was the jury selection of maybe getting just the right person possibly there.
I've heard that jury selection is everything.
Oh, it's an art. It mm-hmm. is an art. And then, of course, you know, the fact that this guy, fella, you know, Plus the cop thing.
All of it.
Oh, yeah, a combination. But anyway.
Well, if you just joined us, we're talking with Terrence A. Gross with Gross and Schuster. This is Pep Talk. If you've got a question, please text it in at 850-437-1620.
And so, again, I would say back in the day, I would, because depositions take time mm-hmm. and they cost money. And I would get retained by someone, but I get a cost deposit for a court reporter because, again, I can't tell you how valuable these depositions were when you take them maybe 6 weeks after the event, but then you don't go to trial for another 2 months. So there's like a 2 month gap, maybe, or between the deposition and the trial. And again, in civil law, this would never happen, but a criminal, you got this young prosecutor, the big load, and the officer's never seen his deposition, and I would just nail him. So I had this other case, and it was a highway patrolman who I knew quite well had arrested this fella for DUI, and it was a car wreck. It was a little fender bender. It wasn't a mm-hmm. bad car wreck, but a fender bender. And you know, we all set our memories. You know, sometimes we're so sure about things, but maybe our memories play tricks on us.
Mm-hmm.
So my guy had been driving a white car that rear-ended somebody at a red light. Well, the officer testified in his deposition that was blue.
Oops.
And I got him to say dark blue. So he probably, what happened, I bet you he got other, you're patrolling a lot. Probably got this mixed up with another case or mm-hmm. something. I don't know. But the long story short, we get to trial. And he's sure about my client's DUI. He's sure that my client was this and sure about my client was that. And I said, and you're sure that my client's car was blue? He goes, I'm absolutely sure. I'm absolutely positive. So you're as positive that his car was blue, as your opinion is that he was also DUI, that he was under the influence of alcohol. Yes. And I got just hung up. And then all of a sudden, we started introducing pictures of the car, and it's white, white, white.
Oh, boy.
And you've just seen his face.
Oh, boy.
When and the jury's looking, I mean, because he was so adamant about it, and it just... It was just one little thing, but it just kind of undid all his credibility about, you know, are you sure about this and that mm-hmm. and the other? And so anyway, that led to a not guilty on that case. Because again, reasonable doubt, you know, and that's what you just plant the seeds of that. I'll tell you a quick thing. So, and some judges would get mad at me. There was a couple of judges because I would use this in my jury selection. I'll go as quickly as I can. But in my jury selection, I gave this example. Let's presume that you are a mother and you'd made these fresh blueberry pies. And you put them in the window to cool off. And your son, 8-year-old son, comes to the kitchen. He knows he's not supposed to have any of that. And he knows, you know, you had to wait till after dinner. He knows all the rules. But he goes, I bet you if I could just take a little slither, Mom, she'll never mind. So he takes a little slither with a knife of the blueberry pie, and it's so good. It's warm. And one slither needs another. Finally, it's about quarter of the pie is gone. He's eating a quarter, and he knows, oh,
oops.
Crap, I'm going to get in trouble. So he sees the cat sitting there in the kitchen. So this is a smart boy.
Oh.
He takes the cat's paws and starts putting them in the blueberry pie, and pushes the cat's whiskers into the blueberry pie.
Oh, no.
And then quickly throws the knife into the sink and whatever. And so mom comes in. And first of all, when mom comes to the kitchen, she sees blueberry paws all over her floor, right? So, and this is all about circumstantial evidence, because DUIs are circumstantial more, you know, you have to add things together. So my whole point was circumstantial evidence can sometimes be tricky. So she sees the blueberry paws. She sees the blueberry on the paws of the cat. She sees the
mustache
and the whiskers, and she knows exactly what happened. She knows without any doubt that the cat got into her pie. She whacks the cat with a newspaper, and because she's convicted this cat of getting into her pie. But I said, there's a danger of that. Had the mother looked a little closer, maybe thought, cat's eating blueberry pies? And what about that knife with the blueberry stains in the kitchen sink that the boy left behind? The cat certainly didn't use it.
Yeah.
So the telltale. So, and maybe a edge of that pie stick where it had been cut and not so much, you know. So just as she looked closer, and then you take that same thing with the officer, because, you know, I used to always use the biblical language, seek and ye shall find.
Mm-hmm.
So you were officer, you are a designated DUI officer, because they used to have designated. So your job when you go out is not just speeders, but you're on given nights, you're really looking for DUI people. Yes, that's my job. Seek and ye shall find. So you already got this built-in bias.
Right.
That you're, you know, and eventually you're going to find somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go over all these little things and getting the red eyes and whatever. And sometimes that they used to do videotapes of the people in jail. And sometimes people did way better than the officer. The officer saying, oh, he can't, he's falling. I mean, I thought he was going to hurt himself because he couldn't walk the line. I had to catch him. And meanwhile, you got the video 20 minutes later at the jail where the guy seems okay. He's, you know, he's not swaying and he's not stumbling and, you know, all these things the officer said. So then they quit using the videos because we were impeaching the officers with the videos, so they did away with the video program.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I used to argue, wait a second, didn't you used to have videos so the jury could see them? Yes. And now you don't. Why? And they go, you know, and so whatever. It was just playing devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. And so I did that. But nowadays, representing people that are victims of drunken drivers, I prosecute them civilly. One of the first things I do is I get the prosecutor's entire file. So I share with the prosecuting attorney. They give me the records. And in return, I give them stuff I get through my own investigation, pictures of my client's wounds maybe or medical bills or whatever it is. I work very closely with these young prosecutors. But that's where they start. So most of these prosecutors I'm dealing with are, you know, 25, 26 years old, because that's where you start, misdemeanor state attorney's office before you go to felonies. Looks like we're out of time. This is Terrence. It's been great going down memory lane. If you wish to call me about a personal injury case, you can call me at 850-434-3333 or visit us on the web at grossandschuster.com. I think in the next few shows, I'm going to go down memory lane, whether it's personal injury or other cases, and share them with you, because it's been a long career, and it's fun to reflect.
I'm fascinated by it, and it fascinates me that you were on both sides, on the prosecutorial side and also on the defense side. It's very interesting to me. What a plethora of knowledge you have, Mr. Gross.
Be back in a couple weeks.
Okay, thank you so much, Terry. It's great to have you in the studio. This is Pep Talk, Pensacola's expert panel with Meg. We're here every day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. I hope that you will join us.